You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. Today I'm talking with Heather Morgan, who is the Dean for Enterprise and Innovation and a lecturer in Applied Health Sciences at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. Welcome, Heather, to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
And how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yes, we have a very cold day here in Aberdeen this morning for late April. So it's been a bit frosty, but it's beautiful and sunshiny. So feeling good about the day.
Fabulous. You are a multidisciplinary social scientist with an amazing background, and you are trained in several areas, including law, French language, forensic medicine, philosophy, gender studies, social research, sociology, criminology, and health services research. I'm curious, which one of these fascinating areas would you say is the closest to your heart, and why?
Goodness, yes, it's been a bit of a journey. I'm not sure if it's where I began or where I am at now, really, or actually how they're tying back together. But law, I suppose I was really passionate about pursuing, and I feel that my undergraduate training in law really set me up very well, not to become a solicitor, because that's not what I did, but it just gave me a really good grounding and training and way of thinking and approaching things, which I think is still very much in me in everything that I do and in all of the other studies and disciplines that I've pursued and worked in. But in terms of the applied health sciences, I moved into applied health sciences 10 years ago, and I think to me, it really just crystallized a way of working that was multidisciplinary, that really celebrated different disciplines and brought them together and enabled people to work together to solve problems. And for me, every day I can bring my legal training into that, but I can bring the other disciplines too, and I can work with health psychologists, health economists, I work with statisticians, epidemiologists. We all come together to work on problems in health services, and I like the very applied nature of it, I think. And so I'm not sure if that really answers your question, but you know, my journey, I think I've just loved studying all of these different disciplines, and I see the connections and how they're all relevant to. So I think sometimes we pursue a discipline because we want to be an expert in something, and I think that's also important. But I love the fact that, you know, when you learn in different ways and you can bring different ways of thinking about things together, we can achieve more.
Can you think about your reasons as to why you chose the multidisciplinary social or the studies that you have done? And then talk about your journey to Dean for Enterprise and Innovation.
Yes, certainly. So when I was at school, it was kind of guidance from teachers that for my grades, I should either apply to do law or medicine. And at the time, I remember thinking, oh, goodness, I could never work in medicine because I'm really, really clumsy and quite squeamish, and I couldn't be a doctor. So that's why I ended up applying to do law. And I was quite young in the Scottish system. My parents moved to Scotland. I'm from England originally. My parents moved to Scotland, and I really didn't like school, actually. When I moved at age of 14, and it was awkward. And I realised you could apply to university at 17 in Scotland, which in England it was 18. And I thought, oh, good, this is my way out of school. So I applied when I was 17, and I thought, I don't want to go too far. I feel quite young. I was just 17 in a month. So I applied to Aberdeen because it was on the doorstep. And when I came to the end of my degree, my law degree, I was like, I don't want to leave university. I love this place. I love Aberdeen University. I love being in the university. And I suddenly realized I just didn't want to leave. So I tried to, I can remember going for an appointment with the career service and saying, you know, I want to stay. What can I study instead of the diploma? And ended up doing the philosophy and gender studies because it gave a kind of training in a range of disciplines. The gender studies opened up. It included law, but it included medicine and other arts and social sciences. So I thought this will give me something quite broad and let me see what other things I could possibly do. And that led me to really get interested in research, which is then why I pursued a master's in research. And then that's really what grounded me for the role. Even though I did my PhD in criminology, I've always worked on research around public service delivery. So with prison service, police service, and now health service. So there is a thread there. And to me, it's always about doing research that can be useful for society. It's always been really important for me to work with external organizations and to find solutions to real world problems rather than just working inside of the university. And most of my research has been ethnographic observational research. It means going out of the university, being in different environments and settings and seeing things happening in real life and observing and witnessing. And I think for me, that has just given me so many insights into ways of working. And I think because I've always really cared about that connection with for the research with the outside of the university, that's really led me to my journey to Dean for Enterprise and Innovation, because so much of what I've been doing over the last few years has been working with organizations, but also working with innovators and startup companies. My area is digital health and technology. And so working with lots of startups and people with ideas about solutions, creating solutions to problems. So I think that really has been where it's all culminated. And because of my multidisciplinary background as well, I can see how the interconnection of things, for example, if you're creating technological devices, the kind of legal aspects, the ethical aspects of that, different social lenses that you can apply through sociology. And so I think for me that all kind of comes together in that kind of a role.
And of course, when I saw that Dean for Enterprise and Innovation, it suits you perfectly.
It does feel that way. I'm just three weeks into the job now. But when I saw the role was advertised, I thought, wow, this is, and I keep describing it like this. It feels to me like the drawstring round the bag of things that I've been collecting along the years.
Yes, and it all comes together in a nice way.
Yes, it does feel like that, yeah. And it's a great opportunity to really pursue the agenda that I've been working towards myself, but actually to kind of spread that and share that across the university and to be working with others who are interested in doing similar as well.
So how would you describe your leadership style?
I was awarded a kindness award last year, nominated by some of my students from different cohorts, and that made me really reflect, because I wouldn't have said kindness is my style, but it's interesting having read their testimonies about how they felt being, you know, working with me and me as a leader. So that was an interesting reflection from other people. To me, it's about involving people. It's about kind of informality. I feel that learning doesn't always happen the best work doesn't always happen in a space that is formal or is the classroom or is within set hours and given times. And I'm very much an open person. I'm very much someone who uses social media. I share things that are happening in my whole life on those platforms with both colleagues and students. And I think it's about seeing the kind of the work and life and the balance and the interest and the curiosity and the things that you notice outside of work as well. And being very approachable is important to me, and making people feel really comfortable in my company, I think is the most important thing to me. So it's always something that when working with people, it's about getting that, establishing that comfort in the initial kind of meetings or conversations, and then going from there and actually allowing people to really share their own interests, concerns, ideas, and surfacing them from the ground up. That's the thing that really, I think people have to care about what they're working on or care about what they're working towards. And until you can find out what that is, then it's almost not really any point. To me, it's about focusing on that in the first instance, and when you really get that person and get their interest and get where they want to go, for me that's a way of then being able to lead, but to go with people on their journey and find ways of supporting them and encouraging them and you know, piecing things together to help their pathway show itself to them and for them to have the confidence to take those steps.
So what do you think are the differences when you think about women's and men's leadership?
I found this like the most difficult question to kind of reflect on, I think, because it's interesting. I've been on a women's leadership course and, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on what are the differences between women's and men's leadership. I have to say that in terms of my own examples of men's leadership and mentorship of my career and my opportunities, I've always been, I suppose, I don't know if it's lucky, if that's the word, or if, you know, it's been particularly great male leaders who have been there for me, but I don't feel that there have been differences in the examples that I've been shown as such, or the opportunities that I've been given or supported or, you know, encouraged in taking. What I would say is in the department that I'm in currently, there's lots of strong women's leadership that you know, my sort of line management structure, there are lots of women who are leading the way. And I think making it, you know, obvious and apparent that, you know, women can go for opportunities, should be going for opportunities, shouldn't be waiting, shouldn't. And I think there's a lot of informal coaching and, you know, examples and a culture, I suppose, of being encouraged to work towards leadership. And I think over the last few years, that influence has been just growing around and bubbling around, that it's our culture here in this department that women work towards leading, women lead. And women lead other women towards leadership. So I think there's two things. There's a kind of personal examples and people, you know, I don't really feel that there have been differences, but then I know that in the current department I work in, there is definitely that that cultural shift. And I think that makes people look at themselves or consider their own journeys in a different light. I can't quite put my finger on it, but it is, there's just this culture of we can do, we not, rather than, oh, I'm not quite qualified yet, or it's a bit early in my career to do that, or I'm not really sure, maybe I should wait. All of that has kind of gone. and I think it was there, you know, and I'm not sure if the shift is just about this department or just in general. There are so many women's support networks now within universities, across universities. And I think it's much more celebrated and encouraged and talked about in general. Yeah.
And yet you use the word luck. You said, oh, yes. Perhaps I'm lucky. Isn't that very female kind of thing? Instead of saying, I'm quite skillful.
Yeah, that is. And I think you're right. The language is, and I suppose it is about seizing opportunities because you are qualified to take them rather than because luck has a hand in it. And I think you're right, you know, the language, it's quite subtle, isn't it, that these kind of words slip in. And, you know, I always read over what I've written and, you know, try to, and the same when I'm reading CVs of students and, you know, people I'm mentoring. I think actually other people do that better for you than you do it for yourself. And you kind of forget. I think that's a really important thing, actually, spending that time and offering that to other people, because that's when that's been offered to you, you know, that feedback on things like applications and being open around things like how you present yourself on your CV or your promotions applications, and not thinking, oh goodness, this is really uncomfortable, but actually sharing and reflecting with others so that, you know, we do share those ways of writing, those ways of articulating ourselves and making it more comfortable for each other.
Yes. And the other one you mentioned was how students consider you kind. And I just think that's a wonderful word of describing a leader, someone who is kind. And even better than kindness is someone who I can trust.
Yes. I was going to say, no, trust, you're right. And I think if you show kindness, you can build trust. And I don't think by showing, I think kindness isn't something that you do. It's something that you are. It's not in the individual acts. It's a way, it's a space that you create. And from that you can, you know, build that trust. And that when people do trust you, they share, you know, the very personal. I think in academia, the personal is and the professional are so intertwined that it's really important that we're not sort of just performing as professionals, but we do really get each other and get what we care about. And trust is really important in that, particularly if there are power dynamics or hierarchies that we're trying to break. Because to me, I learn from students every day. It's not about me being a powerful leader or the hierarchy of being staff and student. It's about how do we work together, because we all bring things to the table, and how do we get the best out of the opportunities to work together for everybody. So trust is, yeah, I would agree.
Of university has changed, and if so, in what way? So do you still think it's pretty traditional?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because Aberdeen University is, well, it's 528 years old now, or is it? No, more than that. But we were established in 1499. So sorry, my maths is not met. Yes, but yeah, it's a traditional university, and it's interesting because reflections internally within the university, you know, we're very proud that we have this long history. But equally, I think, you know, we live in 2023. The world has certainly changed over the last few years. And I have always believed that the university should be about, you should have a role in society, not just for itself. And it shouldn't just be about doing research and understanding things and it for ourselves or for our own, you know, to move disciplines forward, for example, or writing papers for other academics to read. I think that has a role and it is important. And I think the training of students in the rigors of each of the disciplines and the histories and the rich histories is really important. But I think, you know, most of our students are not going to go on to become academics. They're going to go out into the world, and we want them to make a difference, and we want our university training to prepare them for that, and to be leaders themselves, and to be able to think and to problem solve and to work with others in other disciplines, to work creatively, to work in different industries. And to me, you know, it is about, well, what difference does a university educate, and for me, Aberdeen is my university, you know, what does an Aberdeen education mean in the world and in society? What things are our graduates doing that are actually making the world a better place, making society better, making the economy better, making the planet better? And that's really, to me, I think what it shouldn't be about, oh, well, I studied to get a law degree, or I studied to get a degree in geography, or now I have a master's in public health. Yes, that is the degree, and there are standards that are things that you need to do to be able to attain those degrees, and there are standards that we have. But to me, it's about that thinking, okay, so I have this degree, what can I do with it, where can I take it, and serving society. And I think we need to be much more open about that. You know, we are in the service of others in society. And I think the other thing that we need to be a bit more responsive to is and I see this in a lot of the funding streams for research now, it's about solving real world complex problems, rather than working on sort of your own area in isolation. And I know it's really important that we have people who are developing expertise in very specific areas, so that we have that sort of detail, but we also need that bigger picture thinking and the ability to bring those experts in specifics together to solve problems that require more than one discipline, or require more than one method, or, you know, those kinds of things. And I think we need to encourage students in that way. So while they do their degree within their discipline. I think we need to foster much more of a cross-disciplinary working, problem-solving, you know, innovative ways of working, so that our students have more opportunities to mix with academics from different disciplines, to have work placement opportunities, to have exposure to local partners in the region, to global partners. I run work-based learning courses where we're able to work with small to medium enterprises, we work with charities, third sector, government organizations, and students get to work with them on something that, you know, to apply their skills. And I think it's really important that our students have those opportunities as part of legitimate degree credit bearing, you know, not just extracurricular activity, but actually built into the curriculum where they get to apply some of their knowledge and skills in a real world setting to understand what contribution they can make and to be ambitious about what contributions they can make in the future.
Yes. Mm. And it's, of course, it's about sustainable education. That's what you're talking about.
Yes, and being leaders of the future and, you know, inspiring generations and, you know, the connections between generation networking is so important as well, you know, in sustaining. And you mentioned sustainable education. You know, in that, to me, it's really important to connect our current students with our alumni and to, you know, for students who may be applying to the university to be able to see the kinds of things that the university is doing, you know, to think of it not as a transactional or a time limited thing that you do. It's, you know, a degree, it's lifelong learning, it's a journey, it's about connecting into something that's bigger than the degree, you know, and the experience itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have an interest in digital health. Can you talk about what you mean by digital health?
Yes, certainly. So digital health is something that I've been working on or calling digital health for about 10 years. And to me, I'm referring to wearable devices and mobile phone applications and the use of these technologies in everyday life. So there are obviously technologies in hospitals and specific tools that are digital that are used within care, you know, health and social care professions. But what I'm talking about is much more of the kind of everyday, what's available on the consumer market, you know, commercial tools that are available to people to manage, monitor their health, improve their health, self-manage. I think, you know, we're seeing a transition in healthcare. We're certainly seeing in the UK that the NHS is overburdened. There are lots of specific issues. There are lots of general issues. We have things like obesity as a problem that is global. That our services are not set up to support, manage, you know, and I think there's so many digital tools that are at our disposal. I think there are lots of issues around them, don't get me wrong. And that's why really focused my attention on, but I think there are more creative solutions that are available to us, or creative ways that we might integrate some of these digital tools within everyday health care, so that we don't see health and healthcare as about going to a GP appointment, being given advice or being given a prescription and then going away, but actually something that we're mindful of every day, that, you know, we can use these tools to empower ourselves. I think with mental health as well, we've seen so many applications being developed in online communities and tools to reach more people and to engage more people through these digital tools than we ever have the possibility of, you know, delivering services for. To me, it's, you know, how do we maximize the opportunities that we have, and how do we coordinate, how do we integrate and better organize ourselves around the use of these digital tools. At the moment, it seems that early adopters, perhaps, like I would describe myself like that, will be using these things, but, you know, how can we encourage more people to find the tools that work for them and to use them, but how could we also get healthcare professionals on board with integrating these into healthcare services? I'm thinking as well, like, I have had my genome sequenced, and I think in terms of future, I think tracking, I am a quantified self, so I use digital tools. I have a smart ring and a smart watch, and I use various apps. And I think all of these things, how do we pull them together so that my healthcare profile, by the time, and hopefully I will live to that age, but by the time I'm 70, we can see patterns perhaps in things of, and to inform diagnosis, being taking into account the genetic information and my lifestyle information, my history that I've been documenting. I think we have, there are dangers there in terms of the, well, privacy, ethics, data, and all of those for a start. Then we have like profiling that could then be possible. I mean, I did a Cabaret of Dangerous Ideas performance a few years ago, which was around, okay, if we have all this health information, would we then be only administering official care based on compliance with healthy behaviors? And I'm saying in inverted commas. So there are obviously those kinds of dangers, but, and I don't think they should be used as punishment in any way, but I think we have opportunities to better utilize the digital tools that are available. We do obviously need to be very careful, and particularly with artificial intelligence as well within healthcare. That's obviously a growing area that, it's not going to stop now. But and this is where we need people, because I think there's a lot of concern, like, oh well, if we have digital tools or if we have artificial intelligence, where are the people? Well, to me, the people need to be not repurposed as such, but trained for a future system that integrates all these digital tools. But we need the critical thinking of humans and the coordination of humans and the care of humans to inform how we use these digital tools to our best advantage. So to me, that's really, and that, I think, thinking of, the workforce of the future, graduates of the future, what the role of the university is thinking towards these future developments and things that are already underway that we can't put we can't put the genie back in the bottle, but instead training our people to be resilient, to be adaptable, flexible, responsive to change, and then to kind of harness change and take ownership and lead.
And of course, here I'm thinking about the technology and artificial intelligence, especially ChatGPT. Do you think we as educators and researchers need to fear for our jobs?
I think not. I've been a really I've been enthused, encouraged by ChatGPT and early conversations on that, I have to say. I very quickly, as it emerged, started to play with how we could use ChatGPT in the classroom, and indeed encouraged my students to use it in various ways. And I've given some talks across the university to colleagues to, I suppose, allay fears and show some examples of how it could actually be used. But it's interesting because, I mean, I had a really nice conversation with one of my students a few weeks ago, and I had said to her, why don't you go and try this in ChatGPT and see what it comes up with? And she came back and she said, oh, it was great, Heather, it was really good. And I said, well, why was it really good? And she said, well, it saved 95% of my time. So I said, okay, so how are you going to actually spend that additional time now then? And she kind of looked at me, and I said, well, just because it saves time, it still need you still need to spend the same amount of time working on the problem and working on the task. You need to now think creatively about, if it saved me this much time, what more could I do? How can I build on that? And I think these tools can be used to help us move things forward and to actually free up time to think. And the pressures on workload in universities, everybody's talking about it. But the thing that quite struck me through the pandemic was when students would appear on online meetings for supervision for research projects, they would say things like, oh, I'm really sorry, I don't think I've done very much this week. I haven't got much to show for it. Then we would start to talk, and we would talk about well-being, of course, because that was really important at that time. And then we would go on to the work, the problem, the research topic. And then it would become apparent to me that they've spent lots of time thinking and reading. They might not have written. And I said to them, you know, you thinking is work, you know, this time to think and to process information, to synthesize information. They're the skills of academics, of thinkers, of scientists, of leaders. And actually, if ChatGPT can free up some of the time that we spend on bureaucratic administrative tasks, if they can get us some information and start points quicker, we can actually spend more time doing the things that are actually the real fundamental core of our jobs, which is thinking, talking, connecting, you know, those things. So I actually think we don't need to fear for our jobs. I think we need to be excited about the opportunities that they're almost like providing some sort of antidote to some of the things, the ills that we complain about. And so I'm really encouraged. But I think we need to use them carefully. But I think they might free up some time for doing some of those things that are really about our passion and inspiration in education and, you know, the work that we do in universities. I think this is right. And I was just before we met to record this, I was listening to a talk by the Royal Society of Arts, or hosted by them in the UK. And it was about education and education of the 21st century. And it really focused back on schools, actually. And it was saying that, you know, school age young people, they are still being taught in a system of, you know, being rote learning, being tested on things and not giving the opportunity to think. But actually some of the digital tools that they're using in their personal lives, like being able to curate a Spotify playlist or plan how they're using their game or playing their game, they're doing all of this creative thinking in their personal lives around the digital tools, but the education system isn't facilitating the use of and bringing that thinking and critical thinking into the classroom, because it's kind of, and this need to actually foster that from a young age and to encourage that, and that's why critical thinking about what are the conspiracy theories, what is fake news, you know, how do we equip our young people for that lifelong journey.
I know you're involved with several projects, and in particular one that I'm finding fascinating, and it relates to female genital mutation, or FGM, which is a procedure that is illegal but that seems to persist even here in Sweden. Can you talk about the work at the University of Aberdeen and your thoughts on how we are to understand the many impacts of FGM, female genital mutilation, including the legal duty of health and social care professionals in reporting the practices, which of course is a problem?
Absolutely, yes. And thank you for highlighting this project, because it's been a journey, and it began with a conversation with a student who was a medical student at the university, who was saying that she just didn't feel that there was enough education in universities to equip doctors of the future for being able to respond to their mandatory legal duty, because people just didn't know enough about it. And it started with a conversation, and we said, okay, well, let's find out what the scale of the problem is. We conducted a UK-wide research study looking at medical education and medical schools, and found that there was a gap, that people were worried about this, and we went from there. We started to partner with a few different charities working in this area. So we had students working on placements and looking at FGM diaspora, and actually discovering, like you say, it's in Sweden, in the UK, it's all over the world, with migration of people, but also It persists as a problem of people being taken from countries where the practice is illegal to countries where the acts of FGM are still performed and are perhaps culturally expected, and then returning to countries and so on. And the physical, mental, emotional health problems that result. So it's a really complex area, and this is exactly a project that draws together, because it has legal aspects, so it draws back on, it has gender studies aspects, it has philosophical aspects, so it pulls together all these things from my past and into the future, because what we created was a course in conjunction with Future Learn. So we did lots of different mini projects to inform the development of a course that is freely available online. We're so excited. We launched it last year. We've had two course runs, but we're going to make it always on. So it's run as a free course, but people can take it just when the course runs. But from next year onwards, it will be available all the time. And we worked with, health and social care professionals, the police, educators, to look at, this is not a problem for doctors who are working in obstetrics and gynecology. It's a problem for lots of professionals who come into contact with people and who work with people, and it's something that we need greater awareness of, and we need processes in place. We need confidence about co having difficult conversations, and not just this kind of, well, we just report it type thing, but actually, how do we work with people, and how do we bring about cultural change, but how do we support, we destigmatize. So it was really, really complex, but we pulled together a 4-week course, which we're so delighted has been taken by, I think it's about 1,000 people now. We keep hearing that people want more, they want more tailored education and so on. And we're just about to found a charity actually that will be about education, because what we've noticed is there is a gap in the charities. There are lots of charities doing lots of excellent work, and we've partnered with lots of them, we've worked with lots of them. But the one thing that we feel as our the thing that we offer is education, and it's multidisciplinary education. We've worked with so many partners to create the course and to cover it from different lenses, different roles. And so it's really exciting that we've been able to do this and have this impact, and we want to grow it, and that's what we're doing. So we've formed a kind of initial charity committee, which is, it's so interesting, because it's gone from education to this new whole new world, I suppose, of, well, what would a charity, an education charity, look like? And that's quite scary in some ways, and really exciting in other ways, as we pursue that agenda. But it really has been a project of volunteers, of people from different backgrounds, people from different disciplines, and everybody who's contributed to the project is so passionate, and it's amazing to see what people can do when they come together, and what they can produce and achieve, and the energy, and the presence. And before we went on this call, I had several emails about the project. It's a daily conversation, and I think that's really positive that it's not. And I think this is the thing about projects and, these kinds of things we do in universities are not, we tick off the project and it's done, but actually it's about connecting things together, and producing something that is not just for our own sake, but this freely available course, it's available to anyone in the world, and we've been really pushing for that education should be available to all. And yeah, it's just been such an exciting thing to work on, and humbling as well, really humbling, the people who have worked with us to drive it forward.
Coming to the end, is there anything that you want to bring up that you think is important that, and that I have not touched on?
I don't think there is anything. I think we've covered such a wide range of topics, and I've really enjoyed the conversation with you, and being able to reflect on the connections between some of these things. I don't think I have a question as such, although I suppose one question would be around the podcasts and your series. What do you see as the role of talking to people like me? And is it is this for students? Is this for staff? Is this to connect, better connect academics, or to reach audiences beyond that, because I think quite often we have these conversations among academics, and I just really wish we could share them with other people and be open so they can understand what we do in the universities and get involved and, you know, come to us and give us ideas of things that they want us to work on. And I just hope that your podcast reaches out, and, you know, I'd be happy to connect with any of your listeners and in whatever industries, because I think to me it's all about working together, and I love that we have this new connection and that your reach. And yeah, so it's not really a question, is it? Sorry, I just stopped talking.
Yes. No, look, it's a great question, and you know, you just answered it. You answered it by talking. So I really don't need to answer. I just replay it. I replay your answer, because this is all about connecting, exactly what you said. But you know, the one thing is that a lot of people, you know, who are working in the real world and outside universities, they don't have any idea about really what happens within universities. Who are we as academics? What do we think? What do we, you know, we are, like, you know, we are all, I think we are fabulous human beings. We are interesting. We have lots to give. And I think that this, it is a way of connecting. And exactly like you said, those who are listening, it's been interesting, because this whole journey has been a step-by-step journey. So it started during the pandemic, and I just thought, now I want to know what people are doing out in the world. You know, what are they doing here in Sweden? And that's how I started. And I started talking with Swedish teachers. And then from there, I have a lot of colleagues in Australia, and, you know, suddenly I'm finding interest from all over the place. The people who are listening and the people who, they see, it seems to be growing, because exactly what you're saying, people want to know. It's not like the university lives in total isolation. And I think people who work in universities do have lots to talk about. And I've been very fortunate, and I'm talking about being fortunate now, because I talk to you and then you will recommend someone for me to talk to.
Yeah, and I think this is a real, you know, I think it's really important for us to be visible. And like you say, we have so much to give, and we want to, most, you know, many of us, a lot of us want to work with partners and to move things forward and to apply and to feel useful as well, and to be in service, and you know, we have skills and we have thoughts, and we connect things, and it's really important to be able to do that, but to do that in a visible and transparent way that I think benefits society, that really is important. And I think through things like this, having these open conversations and being accessible through them, it really does make a difference.
I think you should start a podcast. Because you're curious and you are perfect as a podcaster. You would be perfect, because you come from the multidisciplinary background.
Well, it's funny you should mention, I launched a podcast a couple of years before the pandemic, but just 6 episodes, and perhaps I need to pick them up again, because I really enjoy talking and talking with other people and connecting. So opportunity and to be connected with you, and I think you've had such great questions. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you very much for your time this morning, and we will absolutely connect in the future. So thank you, Heather.
Thank you. Thank you so, so much. I really appreciate it, and it's lovely talking to you.
And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet i Sverige, or in English, That's Life Here in Sweden, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.